Hi, welcome to another edition of On Science, the NPR Science Podcast. I'm Joe Palca. I'm doing this on my own this week because Christopher Joyce isn't here. We're not sure. Reports that he's been abducted by space aliens are being investigated, but so far have not been confirmed. So I'll do the best I can without him, and we're going to start. We have some interesting things this week. We have a story about a new explanation for Alzheimer's disease. One of the oldest human footprints has been discovered. And, of course, we're still talking about Darwin because it's the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. But first, a few weeks ago, I was in the New York Bureau for NPR, and I became intrigued by a press release I received from Columbia University. It talked about some work that engineers there were doing to develop a new way of determining when a suspension bridge cable might give way. Now, it's an approach that's relevant to suspension bridges anywhere in the world, but as you'll hear at the start of this piece, it's particularly relevant to people in the greater New York area. There are 10 suspension bridges in the greater New York City area. There's the Bear Mountain Bridge, the Mid-Hudson Bridge, the Triborough Bridge, the Manhattan Bridge, the Williamsburg Bridge, the George Washington Bridge, the Throgs Neck Bridge, the Bronx Whitestone Bridge, the Verrazano Bridge, and of course the granddaddy of them all, the one I'm standing on now, the Brooklyn Bridge. These bridges were all built to last, but none of them will last forever. How long they'll last is a question they're trying to answer about 8 miles north of the Brooklyn Bridge in a cavernous room on the campus of Columbia University.
The uniqueness of these bridges is that some of them are over 100 years old.
That's Raimondo Betti. He's a professor of civil engineering and engineering mechanics at Columbia University. Betti is in charge of the program to build and test a new sensor system that will measure the health of bridge cables.
One of the problems that these bridges have is that there is corrosion inside this cable. And so the question arises, what is the strength of the cables after 100 years of service?
Most suspension bridges share the same basic design. Giant cables are strung between two towers and are anchored to the shore on either side. A roadway is suspended below the cables. The cables themselves are bundles of thousands of thick steel strands. Right now, cables are inspected visually once or twice a year. That's okay, but obviously a rapidly developing problem can be missed. Raimondo Betti's idea is to embed tiny sensors inside the cable bundles to track the cable's condition round the clock. Now, it's one thing to put a sensor inside a cable. It's another to know whether it's giving you reliable information. So Betti and his colleagues have built themselves a large glass-walled chamber, and inside they've put a 20-foot length of bridge cable with their sensors embedded in it.
It's an exact replica of a 20-inch diameter cable. Mm-hmm. Now, the Williamsburg Bridge, the Manhattan Bridge, those are bridges that have similar size.
Over the next 6 months, they'll record data from the sensors as they bake the cable with heat lamps and douse it with water, the kinds of things a New York bridge cable might be exposed to.
We are trying to create conditions that are more aggressive than the one out there, because otherwise the system will not be tested. And 6 months from now, we'll open the cable.
Open the cable and see how well the data they recorded match the actual damage to the cable. Of course, even if Betti's sensor system works as he hopes, it doesn't solve the problem of what to do if a cable on a bridge connecting, say, Brooklyn and Manhattan is showing dangerous signs of weakness.
It's impossible to replace a bridge like that in a densely populated area like New York City. You don't have the luxury of saying, I'm closing a bridge, and for 5 years, the traffic will go somewhere else.
It will take some clever engineering and a lot of money to replace a cable. The new sensor system could let them know when that's absolutely necessary. Of course, the money may not be such an issue because the stimulus package has lots of money for projects like fixing suspension bridges. So maybe it's not such a bad thing that they'll know when to replace it. Maybe the money will even be there. That'd be cool. Anyway, moving on. We go next to a story my colleague John Hamilton did. It's addressing a kind of a vexing problem that's been plaguing Alzheimer's researchers, namely what causes the disease? What triggers these plaques and tangles, these strange formations in the brains of Alzheimer patients? Well, as John reports, researchers have discovered a surprising link between Alzheimer's disease and mad cow disease. It turns out both involve a strange protein, something called a prion.
Alzheimer's and mad cow both destroy the brain, but in very different ways. Mad cow and a similar disease in people are caused by prions, not the normal prion protein that all brains have, but a deformed, infectious prion that creates holes in the brain. Alzheimer's occurs as sticky plaques build up around brain cells, but it's been unclear how these plaques interrupt the workings of the brain. They don't seem to affect brain cells directly. Researchers at Yale University thought the answer might be that plaques team up with some other molecule. But they were caught off guard by what they found.
At first, you say, no, that can't be. It's too bizarre that these two diseases would share this common protein.
Steven Strittmatter and his team had screened hundreds of thousands of molecules that occur naturally in the brain. Only one was a good match, the prion protein, or as some people say it, prion.
Now that was a real surprise, not what we were expecting at all. And it's really quite striking because there's this whole, separate from Alzheimer's disease, an entire set of diseases called prion diseases that are based on this cellular prion protein.
But Strittmatter says maybe it isn't so surprising that there's a connection between mad cow and Alzheimer's.
Once you start thinking about the details, there are so many shared similarities that it actually begins to make a lot of sense.
For example, both diseases kill brain cells and both cause dementia. The next question was, what did prions and plaque working together do to brain tissue? To find out, the Yale team exposed mouse brain tissue to the main substance in Alzheimer's plaques, amyloid peptide. In tissue from normal mice, which contains non-infectious prion protein, the Alzheimer's peptide interfered with the brain cell's ability to communicate. Then, the team took a slice of tissue from a special mouse, whose brain contained no prion protein.
That slice no longer responded to the presence of this Alzheimer's peptide. Instead, it carried out completely normal functions, whether the A-beta peptide from Alzheimer's was there or not.
In other words, no prions, no problem. It's still unclear exactly how prions allow the plaque proteins to affect brain cells, and the study certainly doesn't suggest that prions themselves cause Alzheimer's. But Leonard Mookey, a brain researcher at the Gladstone Institutes at the University of California, San Francisco, says although the finding is only in mice, it could be very exciting.
One would want to know whether these disease-causing interactions between amyloid proteins and the prion protein happen in the human brain.
And if it does, could a drug prevent Alzheimer's by keeping prions from interacting with amyloid? Mookey says these questions will be easier to answer because scientists have already spent so many years studying mad cow disease.
We know a great deal about the biochemistry and biology of prion protein, which should really facilitate the development of drugs aimed specifically at the prion protein.
The new research appears in the current issue of the journal Nature. John Hamilton, NPR News.
This is one of those stories that always presents a problem for science reporters because it's an interesting approach and it may pan out, but you're always torn between wanting to say, well, here's a new way we could tackle the disease and, oh my gosh, this might turn out to be nothing. So it's always a question of, you know, do you tell people about it and get their interest and hopes up, or do you not tell people about it and then 5 years later answer the question, hey, that was the biggest paper ever to come out about Alzheimer's. Why didn't you report on it? So that's an interesting problem. But I think as long as you keep in mind that it's interesting research and it may lead somewhere, it may not, you can just take it for what it is. Well, we let Chris Joyce off the hook for the production of this podcast. There's a lot of peas. But that doesn't mean we don't want to hear from him. You might know that Chris is drawn to stories about anthropology, and he's got a good one this week. Chris will tell you that anthropologists feel pretty lucky when they find a fossilized bone from a human ancestor, but one thing that's even more unusual is a fossilized footprint. Scientists have now discovered not one, but two sets of such footprints. They were left in the mud 1.5 million years ago. Here's Chris's story on this rarest of discoveries.
It was a long way to go for fossils, a four-day drive across a desert in Kenya, then months in blazing sun digging through dirt. But the day in 2006 when anthropologist Brian Richmond and his crew found the fossil footprints, they knew they'd made one of the rarest of discoveries.
We looked at this, and at first we had to look at each other, like, do you think this is a human footprint, isn't it? And, you know, and we almost wanted to have our, we wanted to have our colleagues look and tell us that what we were seeing is in fact true. And we couldn't believe it. It was really exciting.
Exciting because of the extreme age of that layer of sediment, 1.5 million years. Richmond from George Washington University knew there was only one set of human-like footprints older than that. They'd been found 30 years ago, but they were from a much more primitive ancestor. These new prints looked, well, like Richmond's own footprint.
These footprints are the earliest footprints of early humans.
They probably belong to a species called Homo erectus, or a close relative, species that eventually evolved into us, and apparently they looked a lot like us.
The prints match a men's shoe size of about 9, which gives you a height of about 5 feet 9 inches.
The prints had been laid by someone walking through mud that had dried and then been washed over with sand and naturally preserved. The shape of the prints and their spacing leads Richmond to conclude that Homo erectus could walk the walk that humans do.
Here we have really compelling evidence that, sure enough, they were walking with a long stride. They had an arch in the foot, the way we have, and the arch gives us a spring in our step, in a way, and it actually makes our walking more efficient.
When the team went back to the dig in 2007, they got another surprise. Digging in a level about 15 feet higher, they found another set of Homo erectus footprints. They calculated they'd been made about 1,000 years after the first set. In all, they now had about 20 prints. John Harris, an anthropologist from Rutgers University who led the dig, says the odds of finding two sets 1,000 years apart are off the charts.
It's just incredible. I'd never excavated anything like this before.
There were lots of other prints there, too. Antelope, zebra, even a form of lion. The place had been a river valley near a lake, a hopping place, says Harris. But the climate was drying out, with greater distances between trees and water. Evolving a more efficient walk would have been a big advantage.
It shows a creature that was capable of increasing its home range, so they would have had to have moved over greater areas of the ancient landscape to sustain themselves in terms of their food requirements.
The footprint shape and the pronounced arch suggest that this creature, like us, had a spring ligament in the foot. That ligament absorbs energy and then returns it as the walker moves forward. That, says anthropologist Dan Lieberman at Harvard University, suggests that a hominid like Homo erectus was not just a good walker, but a runner. Because he had to be.
Imagine you are a Homo erectus and you're hungry and you want to kill something for dinner. The weapons available to you are incredibly primitive. So one thing that early hominids might have included as part of their repertoire of hunting strategies was to run animals in the heat.
Until, Lieberman says, the prey collapsed. The footprints are described in tomorrow's issue of the journal Science. The team will return this summer, and Richmond says he can't wait.
It's almost an emotional kind of connection when you realize that the last time someone stood in that spot where you're standing at the moment was 1.5 million years ago, and it may have even been a direct ancestor.
Christopher Joyce, NPR News.
Well, finally, if you've been listening to these podcasts or listening to the radio or reading the newspaper, in fact, unless you've been living under a rock, you'll know that this year marks the 200th anniversary of Darwin's birth. And what's been cool about this year is it's given us a chance to explore Darwin's genius, because he really was a most remarkable man. My colleague Robert Krulwich spoke with New Yorker writer Adam Gopnik about Gopnik's new book, Angels and Ages. Gopnik told Robert he absolutely loved Darwin's book on the origin of species.
I was just knocked out by it. And to this day, in a lifetime of probably too much reading, of all the things I've ever read, it was the thing that I was the purest experience, where you said, I opened this book as one person and I closed it and I was another person.
But why? I wondered. Gopnik says that it really has a lot to do with Darwin as a writer, but even more important than that, with Darwin as a looker. He was a very, very great examiner of stuff.
He didn't seem to have any gift for the kind of rhetorical argument that lawyers need, or the kind of mastery of craft that doctors have, or the oratorical skills that a priest or a preacher has.
So he wasn't what you'd call these days a fast processor.
Not one bit.
Not that you could tell.
Not that you could tell. He was underneath the table with beetles in his mouth, and he was one of those obsessive kids who cares about one or two things at a time. In his case, he cared about bugs enormously. And his father was in despair because this kid, he was in our parlance, he was on the spectrum. All you could get him to talk about and look at was bugs.
And yet, a lot of parents would think, uh-oh, dumb.
Exactly. Would think dumb, difficult. And his father wrote to him, as you remember, or said to him, you will never be good for anything but dog racing and rat catching. And it was just – and you can imagine what a stab in the heart that was to a bright kid. But that was the kind of mind he had. And if you read a single page of The Voyage of the Beagle, of his account of The Voyage of the Beagle, one of the things that makes it so amazing is that everything he's seeing is beautifully described so that you see it too. And it's done so transparently that you don't stop and think, boy, that is hard to do. But I tell the anecdote in the book, I was in the middle of rereading The Beagle. We were down in the beach in the Caribbean, and I thought, this guy's amazing. He can describe so well. I think, well, I'm not the world's worst describer. It's what I do for a living, too. So I put a snorkel on. I went out into the little, you know, reef pond there, and just to look at fish, I thought, I'm going to look and write down everything I've seen. And when you try and do that in a disciplined way, you realize how impossibly difficult what Darwin does so naturally, that is simply describing the look and behavior of organisms, of animals, how difficult that really is.
Well, Darwin really was an amazing – he had an amazing mind, and he addressed problems in a very interesting way. And as I was reading Origin of Species, I was struck by a passage that he talks about in the section where he's grappling with the struggle for existence, because a lot of his theory about natural selection or evolution by natural selection is that there is this forces of nature that are – getting rid of some species. I mean, extinction is part of the scenario. Some species die out because nature changes and their particular attributes are not favored. And then if mutations occurred, although, of course, he didn't know they were mutations, but varieties appeared that were beneficial, then they lived longer. Anyway, one of the things he talks about is this, how plants and animals relate to one another and are bound together by what Darwin calls a complex web of relations. And he tells this wonderful story about bumblebees, or as he called them in those days, humblebees. Here's what Darwin wrote. The number of humblebees in any district depends in a great degree on the number of field mice which destroy their combs and nests. And Mr. H. Newman, who has long attended to the habits of humblebees, believes that more than two-thirds of them are thus destroyed all over England. Now, the number of mice is largely dependent, as everyone knows, on the number of cats. And Mr. Newman says, near villages and small towns, I have found the nests of humblebees more numerous than elsewhere, which I attribute to the number of cats that destroy the mice. Here's the key bit. Hence, it is quite credible that the presence of a feline animal in large numbers in a district might determine, through the intervention first of mice and then of bees, the frequency of certain flowers in that district. So Darwin is tying together cats and flowers. And it's just this amazing ability to look at the natural world and see the interconnectedness of it that I think is partly key to Darwin's genius. Anyway, that's it for this week's podcast. Thank you for listening. If you'd like to write to us, we have an address. It's nprscience@npr.org. Love to hear from you. And in any event, we'll be back next week with another On Science.